Key West officials tackle cruise ships again. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Key West leaders want to fulfill the wishes of voters and limit the types of cruise ships that can port at the city. But legislators overturned that vote during the session. Can the city fight back on behalf of the voters? Also, another person was arrested in the ongoing investigation of the assassination of Haiti's president. We'll get the latest update. And finally, this time of year is tough for residents of Western Palm Beach County. This is the time when sugar companies use the practice of burning sugarcane before harvest. Some of the people living in the area want to sue to stop the fires. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. We were going to have Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava on today to talk updates on the Surfside condo tragedy. Unfortunately, her schedule did not allow for her to be on, but we will get her on the program as quickly as we can to talk more about that. So let's switch gears and talk about something that happened in Key West yesterday. Key West officials decided to take up the hotly debated issue of cruise ships again. Well, last year, voters on the island agreed to city charter amendments that limit the number of passengers and types of ships that can port in the city. Then, this year, during the legislative session, lawmakers decided to overturn that vote and said that voters could not make that kind of decision. But can the city of Key West challenge Tallahassee on this? Well, joining us now is WLRN Keys reporter Nan Klinginer and City Commissioner Jimmy Weekly. Commissioner Weekly, I want to start with you. Tell me about the meeting last night. What was it supposed to be about?
It was a workshop, actually, to discuss what our options were in moving forward. You know, between the three referendums that were on the November ballot last year, which all passed by, you know, I guess you would call it super majorities of 63% or better, the voters said, hey, we want to limit the size of our cruise ships. We want to make sure that they're not damaging our environment in any way, and we don't want more than 1,500 passengers coming into our streets.
All right. Now, we heard during the meeting, you heard from voters on both sides. Let's listen in on this one. This is Nathaniel Linville asking commissioners to reinstate those limits.
The concern that I have as a voter and as someone who lives here is our vote has been taken away from us.
And then you had other people who were happy to see the city charter amendments overruled by the state legislature. This is Christopher Ellis, who owns a bike tour company on the island.
It's ridiculous, this whole thing. We might as well just say, our new motto is, we are all members of one human family, but some of us are more human than others.
All right, Commissioner Weekly, how did you feel about what the legislature did, basically overturning the voters' desires?
You know, I don't understand how they could do that, how they could preempt something that it was a local issue, it's our home rule, and we were, like I said, it was overwhelmingly supported by the voters of this city, better than 63%, and how the legislature then come through a back door and preempt what we have done, what our voters have said, I think it was disgraceful, and that's why the city is moving forward in a different avenue and trying to provide what the residents want in this community by looking at drafting ordinances in which to be able to implement the referendums.
And we're going to talk about some of those ideas that you have. And Nan Klinginer, I mentioned it at the beginning, but just a reminder of what this amendment was. What did voters, again, decide on back in November?
Yeah, they decided that no more than 1,500 people a day should be allowed to disembark by cruise ship in Key West, that no ship with a capacity of more than 1,300 people should be allowed to call here, and that the city should prioritize ships with the best health and environmental safety records.
What reason did lawmakers, Nan, in Tallahassee give for why they wanted to overturn this if the voters overwhelmingly said, no, we don't want this?
Yeah, they basically said that I think there was a quote from one of the sponsors that 10,000 people in Key West couldn't set policy for the state of Florida and tell, you know, a million people a year that they couldn't visit Key West by cruise ship. They were saying that the city and the especially the voters, as it came down to it, just don't have this authority and that there shouldn't be differing rules for different ports.
Now, my understanding, though, this is about one particular pier, right, where all the cruise ships come?
It's a majority of the cruise ships, and it's the one that the city itself does not run. It's privately run.
I see. But so I guess the question comes down to, if it's privately run, who really has the power to set the rules? Is it the city or is it the state?
Or is it the company that leases it?
Or is it the company that leases it? Okay.
Yeah, that's what we're going to find out, I think, in the next few months.
Mr. Weekly, what can the city do? When you talk about a privately run pier, this is Pier B, I believe is what it's called. How do you implement any rules, even if the voters wanted them?
There was an agreement almost better than 30 years ago between the city and the pier at the time. And at that time, you know, the city was economically being challenged, and we needed to try to increase our economy in some method. And we saw an opportunity here. Well, it's kind of expanded from that. I mean, we're getting some days we could have three cruise ships in at the two piers the city owns, as well as the private pier, and we could have as many as 10 or 15,000 people on the streets at the time, mainly Duval Street, which is a small main street, narrow. Most people know it, and so it was impacting the quality of life. So after 30 years, I think it's time, you know, that we address the issue. According to the agreement that we have, we're able to do that. But you know, that the time passed, and now if we want to look at it again, but it has to be mutual agreed between both parties. The city can't say we no longer want to do this. Both parties would have to agree not to do it any longer.
And you're talking about
I'm thinking that, you know what? An agreement that long that has committed future commissions to something that changed as rapidly as this has, then we ought to be able to end that relationship. And that's what we've asked the attorneys to find out. One, how's the best way to go about doing that?
We're talking about Key West and this question of cruise ships. And again, going back to the vote in November, when a majority of people in Key West decided they wanted to limit the number of people who can come from cruise ships to the city, they voted overwhelmingly for this, but then the legislature overturned it. We're talking with Jimmy Weekly, City Commissioner, and also WLRN's Keys reporter, Nan Klinginer. And by the way, we want to hear from you, your thoughts on this. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Your thoughts on how to go forward with this? Because if the state has made its ruling, where does the city go from here? All right, so Commissioner Weekly, you've asked city staff, come up with some ordinances. Let's figure out how we can do a workaround. I mean, is that what you're trying to do? Are you trying to find a loophole? Or are you trying to find a way to work around the state's power?
Well, in the legislation that the state passed, it left open the possibility for the city to be able to do it through ordinances. The legislature itself says that it can't be done by referendum. And so since this is not a referendum, this will be done by the action of the city commission. Majority of the commission would rule on, you know, would vote on it. And if it passed, then we would be able to implement what the referendum said, but just through a different avenue of doing it.
Nan, you tweeted out something, a comment from the city attorney, worried about lawsuits. If this happens, Sean Smith is the city attorney. What did he say? What is the fear?
Well, his comment was that this would be the duck tours on steroids. And duck tours was a case where the city lost and ended up settling for $8 million, which, as far as I know, is the largest settlement the city's ever paid. Jimmy could probably tell you for sure.
So it's a fear from the city attorney that if any ordinance is passed, if the city tries to implement this, that basically you're just looking at lawsuits anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Mr. Weekly, what do you think about that? What's your response to that?
Well, you know what? If the legislature hadn't taken any action at all and let it move forward within the city charter. We were going to be sued anyway. So either way, we were going to be sued by, Pier B, the owners of Pier B. And, we've been sued before. We win cases and we lose cases, unfortunately. I still disagree with the outcome of the Duck case, but that's a different topic. But anyhow, so I'm leaving it into the hands of the city attorney. He's asked to have additional funds put in our budget for next year so he can hire some outside counsel to help him research and see if there's an avenue in which. If there isn't, then we will have that discussion again as to how we can proceed. And it may take a couple of years or a few years before we can actually get out of the agreement. And that's what I'm hoping we go after is a way in which we can get out of the agreement, that there should not be an agreement made where both parties have to agree to walk away from it, and that the agreement should have been made that every 10 years or so, one of the other parties could have asked to escape from the agreement. So I'm hoping that there will be a way in which the attorneys can figure out how to do it.
Nan, I mean, my understanding is, and I haven't been down there, though I will be down there in a couple of weeks, but that Key West is busy. You got a lot of visitors. There are a lot of people coming down, but the cruise industry is still just beginning. So I don't know, how are businesses reacting to the fact that you're busy, but those cruises haven't arrived yet?
Yeah, well, unless a business is especially dependent on cruise traffic, everybody's gangbusters, and their biggest problem is not being able to hire staff. I was just looking at the hotel lodging tax collections, and April of this year compared to 2 years ago, so before the pandemic, before the checkpoint, is up 40%.
Wow.
Sales tax collections are way up over that year, and that was a banner year, a record year. Our airport is bursting at the seams, as anybody who's flown in and out of here will tell you.
Yeah.
It's crazy. People are doing well. Their biggest problem is they can't find staff.
Mm.
Yeah. Can I comment on that also?
Yeah, Commissioner, go ahead.
And that is that almost every business person that I've talked to said they have had the best years that they've ever had, as Nan was saying. And I think it's due to a couple of things. One is that when people fly in, they're spending more time, they're spending more money, they're enjoying what we have to offer here than a passenger on a cruise ship that's only here 4 or 6 hours, only going to be on Duval Street, basically. And so this is more broad spread when you have visitors coming in that are flying in, that are spending more time. They're apt to see more of the city than just 4 or 6 hours on Duval Street. So I think that has played into the growth of the economy over the last number of months.
So what happened at the meeting last night, Nan? I mean, you had a lot of people, but did you have more folks who had voted, for this limitation, or because things have changed? Do you think people are changing their minds or no?
No. In fact, they sound even more determined. I think because they have seen both changes in the water since there's no cruise ships coming and going, and also that the city is generally thriving. People who say this referendum has been terrible for their business, well, there's been no cruise ships anyway. And these charter amendments have actually had no practical effect. No ship has even attempted to call on Key West since March of last year. So most people, I would say, feel more strongly than ever that they want to see these limits implemented.
Commissioner Weekly, I think about this. Florida is it more than anything. It's dependent on tourism, but of course, one of the challenges is more people come, more people visit, and that does put a strain on our resources. It puts a strain on the environment, and so now here we find ourselves as a state having this question of how do we protect our environment but also protect our economy. They have to be one and the same. And that's a challenge. How do we do that in Key West?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're so dependent upon our reef here, and anything at all that can be detrimental to the reef, we need to make sure that the environment is protected, and regardless of what it might be. And you know, it was mentioned a number of times last night about how much the water quality has improved, how much it seems to the areas, some areas of the reef are beginning to flourish. And it is a balance, and it's a difficult challenge to not only the city, but you said as the state as well. We've got to look at why people come here, what the impacts are, and what we need to do to make sure that the reason people come here is, in fact, assured for generations to come. I don't want my grandchildren to not enjoy the same quality of life that I've been able to enjoy, you know, growing up here. So it's been that challenge, and we do everything we can to protect it. And I think this is just another avenue in which, particularly since we haven't had the ships there, and so many fishermen and so many people that are out on the water all the time have recognized the fact that the water quality, the water is a lot clearer. The water quality itself seems to be, you know, thriving and making improvements.
And it's something that we saw during the pandemic when people were stuck at home. A lot of things changed, and we saw that. I want to thank my guest, Key West City Commissioner Jimmy Weekly, and also WLRN Keys reporter Nan Klinger. Thank you both so much for the insight.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Lewis.
And by the way, you can follow Nan's reporting on this story. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a story that gets stranger by the minute. Now Haitian officials have a new suspect in the murder of Haiti's president. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A South Florida doctor is in custody in Haiti after being linked to the killing of President Jovenel Moise. Another man in custody also happens to be a former informant for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, that according to the Miami Herald. There are calls for more U.S. intervention as the country of Haiti remains without a solid leader in place. Well, joining us now to get an update from Haiti is Miami Herald Caribbean correspondent Jacqueline Charles. Jacqueline, thank you so much for the time. You're there now. I mean, help us understand what's going on. What do you see day to day out there?
Well, today I can tell you that there's traffic, and it's the first time since Wednesday the streets are back, you know, with traffic and people are out. So people are trying to resume their lives. You know, in the beginning there was just a shock. I think there's still that. It feels very much surreal. And at the same time, you know, still wondering who's going to take charge of this country in the coming days and weeks. That still has not been hammered out. People are talking, but, you know, as a matter of fact, I just left a meeting with members of civil society that are now trying to come up with a solution that doesn't include necessarily any of the three gentlemen that are out there and vying to take charge.
And that's the important question is who's running the country right now?
Is the acting prime minister, who was part of a government that had resigned in April when the former prime minister, Joseph Jude, resigned. And so today you have acting prime minister Claude Joseph. It was his note that came out confirming the assassination of President Jovenel Moise. The government said it happened about 1 p.m. today. He himself had a press conference where they presented the members of the government who are going to be taking charge of the national funeral. They have not yet announced a date, but they are working with that. And he has said that, you know, they are on two trajectories, getting down to the bottom of this investigation and finding out who's behind the assassination, and at the same time trying to keep things as normal as possible in this country and keeping things running. And he clearly wants the job.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there are three different people claiming, you know, that they have the power right now. But let's look at some of these stories that have come out over the last couple of days. This one, and from the Miami Herald. There's now a former, current DEA informant in custody. Who is this guy and what role did he play?
He is not a current DEA informant, but this is a former DEA informant. His name is Joseph Vincent, and he is among the two Haitian Americans who were arrested initially and who says that their job was to be translators I debriefed a number of people who spoke with them, including a judge and others, and they basically told the story that they were hired to translate for the Colombians, and that the mission was not to kill President Jovenel, but it was to arrest him based on a warrant that was issued in 2019 by an investigative judge here, which is similar to a grand jury, and to take him to the presidential palace where our third Haitian-American suspect would have been installed as president, and that is Christian Emmanuel Fanon.
And I want to talk about Christian here in a little bit, but what role is the U.S. playing right now in Haiti? Is it just FBI, the DHS investigators?
Well, there was an evaluation team that came over the weekend to look at security, the port, the airport, to sit down with the Haitian National Police to try to get a better understanding of what sort of security concerns they had and requests. And as you know, the Haitian government, the acting Haitian Prime Minister, made a request for U.S. troops, so they have not completely ruled that out, but they're looking into that. We also understand that the FBI will be coming. I'm not sure if they're here yet, but I know that they have started to question people in the South Florida area, given the connections. The Colombians are also here. I've seen them a number of times, and that includes Interpol police officers. But back to the United States, I mean, over the weekend, there was a three-person envoy from the State Department, Department of Justice, as well as National Security Council. They met with each of the three individuals, Joseph Lambert, the current head of the Senate, which is only down to 10 members instead of 30. It is the only chamber in Parliament that exists. The lower chamber no longer exists. They also met with acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph. He was the one that President Jovenel Moïse put on this job on a 30-day basis until he could find a new Prime Minister. And then you have that new Prime Minister nominated, Dr. Ariel Henry, who's a neurosurgeon who has served in previous administrations. President Jovenel Moïse named him days before his death, but had not gone around to installing him, swearing him in. And that is where the debate and the conflict lies. The nominated prime minister versus the acting prime minister, and which of these should be moving the country forward.
Yeah. Now, the Biden administration has said they're not ruling out troops, but who's asking for troops? And how do Haitians in Haiti and Haitians here in Florida feel about the idea of U.S. troops?
Complicated question. Look, you know, it's been more than a century since the Haitian president was, you know, killed in office. The last time that happened, it led to a 19-year U.S. Occupation of this country. That was in 1915. You know, the reality is, prior to the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, this country was dealing and is still dealing with a surge in violence, alarming number of kidnappings. The Haitian police itself has been overwhelmed. Things are calm, but no one is saying that they're going to remain that way. The U.S. is pushing for elections, and people still don't envision a landscape where people can, candidates can go and campaign and people feel comfortable enough to go to vote. The southern part of this country remains cut off today. That is four regional departments, which just a week ago was in the strike zone of, you know, Hurricane Elsa. And we're still very early on, you know, in the season. But, you know, he is asking for the troops. We don't know if the U.S. will do that, if the U.N., which had a contingent here, a peacekeeping mission for 15 years, whether they will step back into the fray and say, hey, you know, let's send some folks here. But it's a tricky and it's a delicate question, right? Because the U.N. doesn't necessarily enjoy a positive reputation, but at the same time, Haitians are realistic and understand that if your president can get killed in his residence, in his bedroom, then what about me?
Right. I wanted to get a sense of what's the difference in the news coverage that you see in Haiti or in Haitian communities, you know, compared to, you know, the difference between U.S. coverage and what Haiti is hearing from maybe Haitian reporters.
I mean, well, actually, I've seen difference in terms of the Miami Herald coverage and versus other U.S. media coverage. I mean, it's not just, you know, to shoot our own horns, but, you know, for us, the Miami Herald, Haiti is a local story. So when we hear something, we're able to put it into context, and we know whether or not it's a big deal. I read a story just now from a certain U.S. publication, and most of it was background, and the first two graphs that they were presenting as an exclusive really wasn't exclusive because we've been hearing it since Monday. I think for a lot of international press to catch up, the last time they were even thinking about Haiti was 11 years ago when this place was struck by a catastrophic 7.0 earthquake. As far as the Haitian media, you know, look, I function because I listen to Haitian media. I listen to the interviews that they're able to access and talk about, but there are stories that they probably will not touch. And everybody understands the sensitive nature of what is happening here. And at the end of the day, you know, the international media, we will get on planes and we will leave, and the Haitian journalists have to deal with it. Today, as I speak to you, is the day of the funeral of a journalist that was gunned down just about 10 days ago. He is one of several journalists that have been killed in this country, you know, in recent years. I can also tell you that the two judges that have been interviewed by a number of people in the international media today are dealing with death threats. The threat levels for them have risen, you know, drastically because they've talked about, you know, what they heard or what they saw, either when they got to the president's house or when they themselves debriefed some of these suspects. So this is a situation that's very sensitive. And I think, you know, the media, the journalists that are here to be, you know, commended for doing it. They're trying to get down to the bottom of the story, but everybody understands how sensitive it is. It's not easy.
Yeah. Again, talking with Miami Herald Caribbean correspondent Jacqueline Charles, and you could read her latest work on the Haiti story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And you know, we want to hear from you. You could share with us on Facebook or Twitter what you're hearing. You know, in whatever media you follow, what are the stories that you're hearing? What are the different things that are coming out of Haiti? Maybe you have questions about. Share that with us on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Jacqueline, I want to get to this other gentleman. You mentioned him a moment ago, Christian Emmanuel Sanon. He's someone who's, you know, at the potentially at the center of this case from here in South Florida. Who is this guy?
Himself as a doctor and a pastor. He's lived in South Florida for more than 20 years. He's got ties. He's filed bankruptcy. He's got more than $400,000 in debt. But according to the Haitian authorities who had him into custody, he was the one who contracted with a firm in Doral to provide these Colombian security agents in order to come to, you know, to come to Haiti. So he was also one of the first individuals that was called by some of the people when they were taken into custody. That is what we've been told so far.
And, you know, a lot of questions obviously come up, and you mentioned it a couple of times now, the Colombians' involvement. Why Colombians? Why Colombian security
group?
That
is a very strange question. I have to tell you, there are more questions than answers in this case.
That, you know, in talking to people from Colombia, I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, what their connection is to this. How have past U.S. interventions been viewed by Haitians? Is there, you know, in this situation, a trust or distrust in Americans' motives?
You know, you're asking me a very complicated question. This depends on who you talk to in terms of Haiti. You know, the reality is that the international community led by the U.S. carries a lot of weight in Haiti. In one minute, people like it. The next minute, they don't. You see people lobbying U.S. officials to help. You see them help lobbying against that sort of assistance. Today, what we are hearing more and more is that the solution out of this crisis has to be a Haitian-led solution. What that is and what that looks like, I think that is a work in progress.
Was there any sign before this assassination that something was being planned, that there was a threat that Haiti needed to be careful about?
I mean, this is a volatile country, and earlier this year, President Jovenel Moïse arrested, had several people arrested, saying that there was a coup against. But this is a president who was contested from the very beginning. But this is very shocking, and I don't think anybody was expecting this.
You know, I mean, we had talked before, you know, I've had you on the show before talking about the situation in Haiti, and we talked about the unrest and kidnappings were up and the instability. What, I mean, with this, has it made it worse?
Like I said, right now things are calm, but there is a power vacuum. So, you know, that's where we're just following it as we go.
How long are you going to be there? What are the stories that you're pursuing right now?
I'm not going to tell you that. This is the hottest story outside of Cuba that's happening right now. I'm not going to show my hand. You just have to read the Miami Herald.
And we will do that, absolutely. Jacqueline Charles, again, Miami Herald Haiti correspondent. You can read her stories on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jacqueline, thank you so much, and stay safe.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we want to hear from you. Share with us on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know some of the stories that you're hearing. Maybe they're conspiracy theories and other things that are out there floating around. Let us know what you are hearing, because we want to follow up on these stories. Again, find us at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, you could stay in touch with us beyond just Facebook or Twitter. You could do it through our Sundial Text Club. Just send us your thoughts, comments, or questions. Text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, just type hello to 786-677-0767. This is a great way for us to stay in touch with you, kind of get an update, a feel from you as to what's important and some of the things that you're hearing. It's also a way for some of our listeners to become part of the program. Well, still to come, every year around this time, sugarcane fields burn. The people living in the smoke are fighting to stop those fires. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Sugarcane burning is a fact of life in western parts of Palm Beach County. The practice involves setting fire to sugarcane fields to burn away the outer leaves before harvest. Every winter and spring, residents keep their children indoors to stay away from the smoke and ash, which has been linked to respiratory issues. The Palm Beach Post and ProPublica teamed up on an investigation of this process and how it affects residents of the county. Joining us now is Lulu Ramadan, an investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post who worked on the story. Lulu, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Mayor of South Bay, one of the towns out in the western part of the county, South Bay Mayor Joe Kiles. Mayor Kiles, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, U.S. Sugar declined to join us for this conversation, but they did provide a statement. Here's an excerpt from that statement. Quote, "The air in our farming communities is safe, clean, and healthy. Our community of family and neighbors remain a priority each day and every day. We live here, work and play here, and above all else, raise our families here," end quote. You can read the entire statement, on our website at WLRN.org. We'll have more on that statement throughout the program. Mayor Kiles, I want to start with you. You've been living in South Bay for more than 50 years now. Tell me about how long this sugarcane burning has been going on. How much of it's been a part of your life?
Thank you for that question, sir. Sugarcane burning has been a part of my life. I worked in the sugar industry in the 1970, during that particular time period before sugarcane burning was in existence in the Glades area. It had been up until this present time. And just by looking around in the Glades area, roughly sugarcane burning, it's a part of what takes place within the sugar industry each and every harvesting year. Starting from October up into mid-March of the following year, where that sugarcane burning have taken place and there's sugarcane being processed. And then later on, there was sugarcane that had been refined in the sugar industry as well. So it was an ongoing business within the
Glades. I mean, is it going back to your childhood? Were they doing this all the way back then?
Well, during my childhood, yes, I have to say that because I was in high school at that particular time period at Lakeshore Middle School. And my father was employed at Florida Crystal, Oklahoma Corporation during that particular time period. And up until I started working there in the year 1970. And then also when I left from there in 1990, and sugarcane was still going on. And as today, it's still sugarcane burning within the Glades area.
You know, Mayor, how do you describe to someone who's never lived through that, never been in it, you know, what it's like when they're burning that sugarcane and then that smoke starts to just permeate throughout the area?
Well, just as one individual, I know there's a lot of people that are not familiar with this particular area here, especially when they come down to sugarcane burning. They see the smoke and they wonder what's going on, why so much smoke is up in the air. Not directed towards the community, because due to the fact the smoke do not blow toward the community, it blows away. And as I started explaining to those individuals, they'll burn the sugarcane for the harvesting season. So once we start talking about that situation, they ask why, and then I explain to them why that they burn the sugarcane, the reason behind it. So in order for them to have a clear understanding about why they burn sugarcane each and every year from October up into mid-March.
Lulu, we reported on the sugarcane burning season extensively as a station, and I know it's an important story for your readers at the Palm Beach Post. When did you start looking into the air quality issues in the western part of the county?
Yeah, it's definitely an important issue in the community, and you all have done some great work on it as well. We started looking into it a little over a year ago. And it was really something that just caught our interest as a paper, of course, because it's happening in a portion of our community. But as far as, you know, the reporting goes, it was pretty far ranging, but we started to look into the air quality and health impacts, and then of course expanded to start doing some air testing of our own.
And how did you team up with ProPublica on this investigation?
Yeah, there's ProPublica has a local reporting network. Basically, they partner with local newspapers from across the country to kind of offer them resources to do some local investigation. So we'd initially made a pitch to partner with ProPublica. This would have been in 2020, and had been in communication with them, and they were interested in offering resources. And so we'd partnered around that time, and then I personally just started to launch into the topic right away.
What's the biggest theme that came from that investigation, just in understanding this practice of sugarcane burning and why it's considered controversial?
I think there are a couple interesting patterns that emerged. One, we did a lot of engagement reporting with people in the community, knocking on doors and just talking to average people, and just to get an understanding of what it was really like to live in the community during sugarcane burns and experience the smoke and ash. But also this dynamic that I know is incredibly important to people in the community, the fact that so many people rely on the sugar industry for jobs, just like Mayor Kyle said. There are so many people in the community that are just, again, rely on the sugar industry for jobs and are tied so closely to it. Wow. So, go ahead, Mayor.
Yeah, no, well, no. We're going to get to that point here in a minute, is the fact that these are small towns. You know, out in the western part of the county, Yippahokee, Glades, South Bay, and then in Henry County, you have Clewiston, where U.S. Sugar has its mill, so these are small little pockets of communities that run throughout. But Mayor Kyles, I'm wondering, how often do you hear from residents about that ash, about that smoke? Or do people keep quiet about it? Do they just accept it as part of life?
You know, I'm not going to say they keep quiet about it, but I haven't heard no one complain about the smoke of the ash. And I have been around in all three of our cities, the Tri-City area, Belgrade, Polka, and South Bay. I haven't heard no one talk about the ash. Haven't heard no one talk about the smoke. Now, the thing about it is that, yes, they understand it and they see it, you know, during the whole time that the sugar industry is burning cane, but no one is complaining in reference to they have a respiratory problem, they have an asthma problem, to my recollection at this present time.
Have you ever had any issues, health issues, respiratory issues because of it? You've been living there a long time.
No, I haven't. I have to consider myself in very good shape. I've never experienced any type of respiratory problem. Even if by being in this city here, I've been in the Glades area, never encountered any type of respiratory problem. And also by working in that particular industry out in the field with those individuals that works in the cane area there, I haven't seen they never encountered no type of problem while they're working out in the field. And during the time when I was out in the field there, I never encountered anything. Hmm. And as of today, I do not have no type of respiratory problem because due to the fact that every year I make sure that I have myself checked. I make sure that everything is okay within my body. And that's one thing I do not have at this present time.
You know, Lulu, you profiled in the story two young boys, Donovan and Jason, I hope I'm saying his name right, Sonson. They had breathing issues. What were they challenged with?
Yeah, that was just one example of several people that we'd talked to who had relayed these sort of experiences. And it starts with asthma early onset. Usually a lot of doctors and nurses in the area also corroborated this, talking about asthma kind of developing pretty young among folks who live out there. But in addition to that, it was just kind of like exacerbating the breathing problems that either were already existing or like just immediate reactions. In addition to just talking to as many people as possible in the community, we also set up an automated text bot during the burn season so we could connect with people in real time. We really wanted to get an understanding of what the experience was like when you first start to see and smell the smoke. And we had people who later experts told us that this was a pretty expected response to it, but who had reactions like, you know, talked about heart trouble breathing or eyes tearing up and things that, again, later experts reviewed those and told us that those were reactions that you would expect when you're exposed to that form of pollution that you get from smoke from agricultural fires.
So you collected these stories of people who were telling you about what the effects of the smoke during during the burning season, what they were feeling. But I just heard from the mayor. He said, no, nobody's saying anything. And he says he feels fine.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard that from the mayor myself as well. And, you know, what we did was we tried to reach as many people as possible. And our goal, we mentioned this in a sort of sidebar story that we did addressing some of the criticisms from the sugar company about our findings. But our goal was to reach as many average residents in the Glades as possible. And we really did. We put in a lot of effort into doing that. We sent letters to people throughout the community. We posted flyers. We handed them out at food distribution sites and at, you know, nonprofits and businesses. We knocked on doors. And we really talked to a lot of people. We talked with dozens of people, and many of them described, you know, exactly what I've described, and then in addition to an interest in understanding what the air quality is actually like in the area and getting a better understanding of that. But several people, and this isn't new, those anecdotes about people who, you know, have claimed health problems from sugarcane burning out in the Glades, that isn't new. That's been reported since the 80s in the Palm Beach Post and old clips that I've gone through. Our goal was to really try and get some sort of more of like a sort of scientific approach, if you will, just to get a better understanding of air quality. But again, those claims about health, they predated the lawsuit that was filed in 2019 claiming health problems from sugarcane burning. They predated the folks who have since come out and the activism and all of that. People have been making those claims for quite a while.
Yeah. Mayor Kiles, I mean, look, as I was mentioning, you know, these small towns are dependent on really one industry. You know, I mean, you look at, for example, in Clewiston, U.S. Sugar, basically the main employer in this one little town of less than 10,000 people. And so I'm just wondering, is there like maybe a little bit of apprehension by people to want to criticize the employer? Like, don't bite the hand that feeds you, right?
I won't say that. One of the main things you're saying, they are the larger employer, U.S. Sugar and Florida Crystal in the Glades area as a whole, but we have farmers as well that hire the individuals from the Glades area and other areas as well, not only just from the community, but we have people that work in those particular industries from the Broward County, also from the other side of West Palm Beach County, West Palm Beach and other areas as well, the Okeechobee, that come to the sugar industries to work during the harvest season there. So by my colleague, which is Mayor Steve Wilson, and I, we communicate, you know, constantly about this so-called sugarcane burning, they call it asthma problem. And we dialogued about that and asked him the same question. Have anyone been talking to you? I expressed to you that they have a breathing problem because of the sugarcane burning. And I know other individuals have came to me during the summertime where they have any problems, you know, about their nose running and all of that, but it's not doing sugarcane burning. And this thing about sugarcane burning called respiratory problem, I don't understand that and why that's going on. Now, the ones that, well, you asked a question about, you know, don't bite the hand that feeds you. I can't say that people's actually saying that, but they know precisely what is taking place in the Glades area dealing with the sugar industry and where the sugar industry have donated numerous dollars to this community. It's a good company to work for. They pay good wages and benefits.
But let me back up for a second, because one of the things you said, and look, I don't have a medical expert on right now to point this out, and I can't say this, but you know, I wonder if you're thinking, well, during the burning season, nobody's complaining. Maybe they're complaining during the off season, but that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a link. That those issues that they're feeling maybe in the summer could still be linked to what they were experiencing during the winter.
I can't answer that either because I don't have a medical background. So I can't say that was a cause of during the grinding season why they haven't run it during the summertime. I can't answer that particular question because I'm not a medical doctor.
Again, I'm talking with South Bay Mayor Joe Kiles. Also talking with Lulu Ramadan, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post. ProPublica and the Palm Beach Post teamed up for an investigation into the practice of sugarcane burning in western Palm Beach County. You can find more details of that story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Lulu, the other thing, too, that came out in the story is there are EPA standards when it comes to air quality. But one of the things that one of the challenging aspects of this story is that were the monitors to track the air quality, are they updated? Are they working properly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was definitely one of the key sort of areas that we dug into with the story. And we basically found that the federal framework for measuring particulate matter, which is this, you know, mixture of pollutants that is a byproduct of agricultural fires, byproduct of cane burning, as well as other forms of pollution. But they track that using 24-hour and annual averages. And what we were really looking at is short-term pollution spikes. What are the potential health effects of short-term spikes? And what does that short-term pollution trend look like in the Glades, where you have individual cane fields set on fire throughout the day for months on end during harvest season? And we basically found that framework, that 24-hour average, was insufficient for capturing this pollution that experts later looked at our findings and linked to cane burning. And, you know, essentially what we have as far as the monitoring situation is there is one monitor in Belle Glade that was placed in 2009 to track PM2.5 particulate matter, very tiny form of pollution that can get into the lungs and even into the bloodstream. That monitor was flagged in 2013 for producing disparities between two monitoring methods. It was deemed unfit to measure against the standards set by the Clean Air Act. And so as a result, you know, that in addition to the fact that the EPA method for measuring this type of pollution, that 24-hour average, just doesn't capture those short bursts of pollution that we found on the sensors we placed in the community. That sparked experts on saying that there should be more of an effort to track short-term pollution trends in the area, just to get a better idea of whether, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and only because of time here, I'm going to have to wrap up. But Mayor Kiles, I want to finish with this. So I'm just getting a sense that you're okay with the burning, even though numerous countries around the world have banned the practice. Countries that grow sugarcane, they banned the burning practice and are looking at other methods. You're okay with it, or do you think that the sugar companies should try to, you know, protect the air quality a little bit better and find better methods?
Let's talk about air quality. You know, I rely on the Palm Beach County Health Department in reference to regulating the air quality, especially in the Glades area here. And once I received that report from the Palm Beach County Health Department in reference to the air quality in the Glades, I'm very pleased with the air quality because we have very clean air and we have clean air to breathe each and every day within the Glades area here. So the question that you asked me about other countries ban sugarcane burning, I can't dialogue on that because I don't know precisely what's going on in the other particular country when it comes down to this particular sugarcane burning.
All right. I'm going to have to stop it there only because of time. Again, Mayor of South Bay, Joe Kiles, I want to thank you so much for your time. And also, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post, Lulu Ramadan, thank you for the insight and letting us get an insight on what's going on in this part of the state that we don't talk enough about. But again, you can see more of Lulu's reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Thanks again to my guest. And just a disclaimer, I have to mention that, I mean, I grew up in Clewiston. My grandfather, back in the 70s and 80s, worked for U.S. Sugar. I also remember those sugarcane burning days. And that was thick, difficult smoke to have to live through. just to point out. That's our program for this Tuesday, July 13th. Coming up, there's no show tomorrow because of the school board meeting, but on Thursday, we're going to bring you more of the latest on what's happening in Surfside after the condo collapse a few weeks ago, and how after the tragedy, cities and counties across South Florida have been scrambling to follow up building certifications and compliance. A new Sun Sentinel investigation looks into how those regulations meant to keep condo residents safe have been loosely enforced in places like Broward and Palm Beach counties. That's all coming up on Thursday's program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.